It's the time of the week when we shoot up to Madrid to the busy newsroom of El País. Joining me from the El País newsroom is George Mills. George, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And yourself?
I'm very well, thanks. Beautiful day in Madrid. We're just enjoying the last of the spring before the summer really hits with a vengeance. So no complaints at all.
Before they open the oven door, absolutely. It's been a busy news week throughout Spain, and also as you said, we are waiting with trepidation the arrival of summer. You're saying also one of the stories that you've been covering in El País is the fact that holiday flats are more popular than hotel places.
Well, that seems to be the latest research. I mean, so basically, as you know, Spain is in the middle of this huge tourism boom that's been going on for a good 2 or 3 years now, thanks to all sorts of factors, including the fact that Spain is brilliant, but also the security situation in Turkey and Egypt has meant that a lot of people who might have gone a bit further afield are targeting Spain instead for their holidays. And so one of the big developments has been the rise in these tourist apartments, and they've overtaken hotels for the first time. That was in 2016. So basically now we've got just over sort of 360,000 beds in tourism apartments, and that's actually more beds than there are in hotels. And it's just been exponential, Giles, as I'm sure you're aware. They're just more and more tourist apartments all the time. The growth has been actually, you know, it's doubled in 12 months. So we have, you know, a really interesting situation with all these traditional hotels faced with new competition. But then perhaps more interestingly for tourists themselves, there's kind of a little bit of a revolt in Spain in some areas against tourism. You've got so many people coming over, and you've got these tourist apartments everywhere. And, you know, people are starting to actually say, well, is there too much tourism? So we've got locals complaining about their buildings in Barcelona or Madrid actually being taken over by tourist apartments. So before, your neighbours were people that had lived there, you know, locals who'd lived there for a number of years and you knew them. And now your neighbours might be 1 week a group of German tourists, and then you might have a couple of days of Italians staying next door. And, yeah, there's a little bit of resentment, you know. And unfortunately, this resentment's also being picked up a bit overseas. So I don't know if you picked up the UK Independent, the newspaper there recently said that the Barcelona is one of the 8 cities that tourists love to hate. Mm. So when you start getting people saying things like this, you have to wonder, well, you know, is Spain starting to have a problem in this regard, you know? And I don't know. I think anyone who's actually tried to get involved in this industry in Spain will tell you that the legal situation's a nightmare. You actually want to rent out an apartment. Every region and every province seems to have its own rules, and then sometimes a city will have its own rules. So it's all very well to complain about illegal apartments in Spain, but with the rules so complicated, you know, you really have to wonder whether it's time Spain kind of owned up to the situation and said, okay, we need one set of rules for the whole country on holiday apartments. Because obviously, if you think about it, in Barcelona, where you have around about 10,000 legal apartments and 6,000 illegal apartments, the city is trying to plan for tourism, and they've got to have a certain amount of cleaning services, transport services, everything that goes in with so many tourists coming in. But if you don't have a good idea of how many people are actually arriving, and you can't tax the owners of properties who are renting out their rooms, etc., well, you've got a double problem. You've got a problem of, you know, millions of people, literally millions, descending on your city. You can't provide for them, and then you don't have the money to do so either. So, you know, there's obviously time, I think, for a bit of a rethink on all this, and for a bit of a systematic approach rather than what's been going on for the last few years, which is just you know, approaching each crisis as it comes. Yeah, so.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I know that Barcelona in particular had a problem with this and with organisations such as Airbnb. And you can kind of understand if you're in a residential block and it's been, because Barcelona is incredibly popular for stag and hen parties, if you're living in a residential block, and, you know, traditionally Spanish have Spanish families have lived in blocks for decades, you know, with a concierge and all that sort of thing, and suddenly you're getting, you know, groups of lads coming every weekend and causing havoc, you can understand perhaps the reticence of people and why Barcelona practically banned Airbnb. But on the other side, of course, the Spanish hotel lobby is incredibly powerful and can really put some pressure on.
Well, indeed, exactly, that's right. And, you know, so if you do just want to rent out your apartment, you should be entitled to do so as well, as long as you do it in the right way. But there is a bit of a problem with this low-cost form of tourism where it's cheap to get to Spain, it's cheap to stay here, you crash in an apartment for a couple of days, you leave rubbish in the hallways, you make noise all night. I mean, it's just, you know, that's not how tourism is supposed to operate, you know. It's great for people to come here and have a wild weekend, etc., but, yeah, it has to be pretty clearly regulated, I think. And as you say, the hotel industry is concerned. They're very concerned about the future because they're holding strong at the moment, and it's a little bit of growth for hotels. But if the situation in Turkey or Egypt or wherever it happens to be does improve, then it's really going to be tough for these traditional hotel owners to fight against this. So the battle lines are drawn, so to speak.
Well, we can probably expect some more red tape because you know how much they like a bit of red tape. If when in doubt, put a regulation on it. Let's move on from one incredibly powerful lobby to another incredibly powerful group who had a strike yesterday. We're talking about our beloved taxi drivers.
Yeah, I put these two stories together, Giles, because there's obviously a lot of similarities. You've got, you know, with the hotel situation, you've got hotels versus Airbnb. And then with the taxis yesterday, you've got the taxis versus companies like Uber and Cabify. And, you know, basically it's another case of Spain's either unwillingness or inability to set any clear rules for these new technologies. I mean, I can't put all the blame on Spain. All around the world, cities and countries are trying to work out how to deal with, you know, these new companies. But, you know, here in Spain, it's been really a bit of a ridiculous saga. Just to give you a bit of a backstory. So we had big strikes yesterday in Madrid and Barcelona, and these have been ongoing. It's the sort of traditional taxi federations coming out and complaining about, so companies like Uber and Cabify, as I said. So basically 2014, Uber was banned in Spain by a court. 2015, Uber returned to Barcelona as a takeaway food style service. 2016, Uber came back to Madrid with these sort of special licenses, which are not taxi licenses like the traditional ones, but they do let you carry passengers. So they're called the VTC license. And they don't give you the same rights and privileges as a taxi driver. And what's concerning the traditional taxi drivers now is they say that these Uber drivers, for example, are kind of tweaking the rules. So with the license that Uber drivers use here, these VTC licenses, you can only pick up a customer if they have pre-booked with your service with the app in this case. But what taxi drivers say is that these Uber drivers, what they do is they kind of loiter near a busy area and they wait until somebody uses the app in that area. And then once they've technically been pre-booked, they go and pick up the passengers. So it's kind of a way of getting around these complicated laws that Uber is supposed to be operating under. And the Spanish Taxi Federation says, well, you know, we need some sort of public digital platform so that everyone has equal access to taxis. But obviously, there's a lot of threads here. You've got the taxi drivers who obviously want to protect their livelihood. You've got the Uber drivers who are also off, or Cabify drivers who also often work under fairly difficult contracts. You know, we're not talking about people earning lots and lots of money, probably being squeezed a bit by the companies they work for. And there has to be some kind of negotiated settlement here. Mm. Because basically, Giles, obviously, Uber is not really going to disappear. Or if that company, for example, left the market, another company is going to come along, because basically that's what people want now. They want an app service. They want to, you know, they want the flexibility of being able to hire somebody at a cheaper rate if they're stuck out, you know, on a outside a club on a Sunday night or whatever. They might not want to or be able to contact a traditional taxi. And as we all know, taxi drivers aren't the best at making friends. You know, if you want to win hearts and minds, you know, they, like yesterday, for example, make of this what you will, one of Spain's like, most important politicians, the leader of Podemos, Pablo Iglesias, was hit by an egg during a taxi protest, and he made light of it. And, you know, obviously it's not the worst thing that can happen, but they do have a bad habit of making themselves look bad, the taxi drivers.
We have heard reports as well of Cabify cars being set alight as well, I read in Spain.
Yeah, I haven't picked up on any of that myself yet, but that has certainly happened in the past. There's been cases of Uber drivers being, you know, threatened, of course. And there were, again, this is not reported stuff, but there was a general feeling yesterday that a lot of these Uber or Cabify drivers did not go out and work yesterday because they were concerned, you know, for their safety. And that's unconfirmed. But, you know, it's obviously very tense. And like with the hotel situation, it's a case of, well, okay, these businesses, these types of business, more importantly, are here to stay. And the regulation, you really have to ramp it up. You can't just react all the time.
This is the thing. I mean, I know in Madrid you're a city, so you're quite used to the having a lot of people walking around getting a cab. You have the numbers. But on the coasts and on the islands as well, during summer, trying to get a legal cab, you know, by calling a number at whatever time it is after a restaurant meal can be, because I think they only have, I know I'm talking about Marbella in this particular case, but they only seem to have one girl on the switchboard at any particular time. So, you know, something like a cab or a Uber is going to sound very, very attractive indeed. And it's up to the cab drivers, I think, to react to this one rather than have a strike and threaten the competition.
That's right, but perhaps the strikes are a response to a lack of action by the government. So, you know, I agree with you that the strikes may seem counterproductive, but I do feel that personally that the, you know, the government is not acting fast enough as well. So, you know, it may be a unpopular and reactionary way of getting people to pay attention, but the truth is it still functions. People still do start to talk about it when these strikes happen. But no, you're right. In the case of a smaller area, it's not just that you might find it hard to get through the switchboard. There just may not be enough taxis. You know, in a busy summer area, you're not always going to have enough drivers.
I can assure you that on New Year's Eve, for example, George, trying to get a cab out of certain places, especially in the Marbella area. Do you remember when the Americans left Saigon and people were trying to get with the choppers?
Well, no, I don't remember it.
But you've seen the images. You've seen the images. It's somewhat like that around New Year's Eve, around these parts. So there you go. Let's move on from that onto a story of a fireman, a firewoman, a fireperson.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jesus, this is another case of law and reality moving at different speeds in Spain. The story here is that I'm about to tell you is like something from a TV show or from a first-year law exam. So basically what we're talking about, Giles, is this case of a firefighter. I'll use that word cautiously here. A firefighter who was reported for psychologically abusing his wife 7 years ago, okay? Now, at the time, the lawyer who took on the case of defending this man was representing a man whose wife had charged him with insults and harassment, but without physical aggression. Okay, so far, so good.
Yeah.
Husband and wife psychological problems, the wife goes to the police and says, look, my husband has abused me. Now, there's a divorce, and the firefighter, during the divorce, starts to identify himself as a woman and is diagnosed with something called a gender identity disorder, okay? So his name is changed in the official register. He takes on a woman's name, and then this firefighter undergoes sex hormone treatment to become a woman. And this is where the complications arise. Okay, Spanish law does not apply to women-on-women abuse, okay? So although the firefighter was a man when he originally abused his woman, bear with me here,
right.
he's no longer a woman, so the lawyer says he can't be tried for that abuse. Now, you could say, well, hang on, he was a man, or this person was a man when they committed the abuse, so what's the problem? You charge him and sentence him as a man. But the lawyer will say, well, because of this gender identity disorder that he suffers from, the client has actually, in a way, been a woman since birth. That's how the disorder works. So you can't then go and say, well, okay, he was a man 7 years ago, so we can charge him or her in that way. But meanwhile, the ex-wife, so you can imagine the ex-wife's feeling on this. They have two children, and they're going through all of this together. The ex-wife says, well, if my ex-husband really has always been a woman, she did so fraudulently actually enter the fire brigade because she didn't meet the qualifications to join the fire brigade having been actually a woman, although she was living as a man. So, oh my God, so this case, which is undergoing, you know, is currently in the courts, could go all the way up to the Strasbourg Court of Human Rights. So really amazing stuff, bizarre story.
Absolutely. It seems to be a lot of cases the real life is moving quicker than Spanish legislation.
Yeah, and it's all around the world, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's easy to talk about these cliches of the world changing really fast and technology changing our lives and social taboos falling away, like, you know, sex changes becoming normal. But along with all that, there's all the, as you say, all the legal stuff that has to run to catch up with people's life stories. And, that's right, three stories with a similar theme today in that sense.
If people want to find out some more information and read more about these excellent topics, of course, there is a website they can go to.
Yep, I would say the easiest thing to do is Google El Pais in English or search for us on Facebook as well. And alongside all this stuff we've been covering, you know, obviously a lot of Spanish politics and a lot of stuff going on in Catalonia at the moment. And if you're just generally interested in Spain and history and society and want to know what's going on, come and pay us a visit.
George Mills at El Pais. Have a great rest of your day. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Giles. Take care.